Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the authors and participants and do not necessarily represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. This series contains discussions of violence and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised. Previously on Algorithm, I spoke with a caller who told me about Darren Vaughn's ruse and her theory about his motivation.
His mom had to be everything about what he went out and killed.
And I asked Vaughn's lawyer, Goyko Kasich, what led Vaughn to change his mind about the death penalty.
From the very beginning, it's one death, and then all of a sudden, about 3 days, 4 days before we cut the plea, he changed his mind.
I hoped that Vaughn might now be open to confessing to more murders, so I sent him a letter. And months later, I received a response from Vaughn, where he agreed to an interview. I, Darren D. Vaughn, would like to offer you a deal. You would have to write a report of the corruption that's ongoing at the Wabash Valley Correctional Facility. But when I contacted the Department of Corrections, they told me he wasn't interested. From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, this is Algorithm. I'm Ben Kiebrick. I think beyond a new confession from Vaughn, one of the best chances we have of connecting him to additional crimes is DNA. Because of backlogs in DNA testing across the country, I wondered if police had ever checked for DNA evidence associated with the cold cases Hargrove had identified, or with other unsolved murders or sexual assaults in the area. I came across an article from the Northwest Indiana Times that in 2018, Lake County, Indiana, had found over 200 untested rape kits and made plans to test them. I was curious what came of that effort. The article mentioned one of the people involved was Lake County Deputy Prosecutor Nadia Wardrip, so I reached out to her for comment. Wardrip is one of four female deputy prosecutors who in 2018 were brought in to reform the way crimes like sexual assault were handled. When I emailed Wardrip, she told me that she wanted to talk, but said she couldn't do so without permission and forwarded my email to their PR person. I looped back a week later, and she told me she still hadn't gotten the go-ahead, but recommended I contact the Fairhaven Rape Crisis Center. It's a nonprofit group that was also involved in Lake County's initiative to test their untested rape kits. I called there and spoke to Becca Emerson.
So my name is Becca Emerson, and I am the anti-trafficking coordinator at Fairhaven Rape Crisis Center.
It turned out that Becca was actually familiar with the podcast.
Can I ask what podcast this is? I'm a big podcast listener.
Sure.
I'd like to check it out.
So it's called Algorithm.
Oh, my God. I listened to your podcast. I was just listening to the one on... Oh my God, I'm sorry. Now I'm like all starstruck.
So when I was looking into this stuff, it looked like in 2017, there was this statewide initiative to look into untested rape kits.
Yes, that is correct. So the statewide initiative was a voluntary initiative put forward by our state to see how many untested kits we had. Because back in 2017 was when the discussion at a nationwide level of the backlog was starting to happen. So this was a big hot topic, and Indiana got on board and said, we need to test our kits. And we need to see how many we have to do that. So there was this initiative. It was not mandatory. And I believe 91 out of our 92 counties did participate, and Lake County was one of them.
Yeah, then I think when I was looking through the report, you know, they asked for all of their jurisdictions to report, and it looked like maybe not all of them had.
Yeah, Lake County did not have all of our jurisdictions report. I do know that some of them did, and I do have those numbers, but not every jurisdiction in Lake County participated.
Yeah. Do you happen to know which ones didn't, or?
Not off the top of my head. I do know that Hammond Police Department had a pretty high number, one of our highest cities in our county. But I mean, we have, I think, 14 different municipalities in our county. We're the second largest county in the state. So in 2017, Lake County came together with our sexual assault response team, with our prosecutor's office, and said, we need to test every single kit. We need to test all of them going back, and we need to test every kit going forward.
According to the audit, Lake County identified a total of 257 untested kits, and they determined that 238 of those kits should be tested. So out of those 238 kits, how many of those kits have been tested now?
All of them. We had, I know I can speak for Hammond Police Department for sure, because I spoke to that detective directly a while ago about it. They were taking 10 kits every week to be tested until their backlog was done. And within the first year after rape kit reform was passed, Hammond Police Department had cleared their backlog. So all 238 have been tested as of now.
And when you say taking 10 kits, is that they're like driving them to the lab where they do the testing, or?
Yes, sir. Every person who has possession of that kit, it needs to be documented who had it and when. So they have to personally drive that kit to our state lab, which is about 45 minutes away. So now what happens when somebody reports in Lake County? The law enforcement agency who is handling the case now has 72 hours to pick up that kit from the medical facility where it was done. And then the lab tests all kits that come in on a first-come, first-served basis. So sometimes it may take 5, 6, 7 weeks for the kit to be tested, but every kit is tested now. And now our entire state has adopted a tracking system. So when a victim is in the hospital and getting that exam done, they are given a PIN number so at any time the victim can go into this database and see where her kit is so they can look and see, okay, it was picked up by law enforcement. Okay, now it was dropped off at the lab. Okay, now the lab is testing it.
So I think I was reading online that the original plan was to dispose of kits that were like older than 10 years old, unless mm-hmm. the victim came forward and specifically requested that their kit got tested. Do you know what happened with that?
As far as my understanding, all kits up through 2007 were tested. But I do know that some of our jurisdictions in our county went back even further and just tested all of their kits. So there were some that were tested from prior to 10 years prior to that.
So some places went back and tested older kits, but mm-hmm. but you're not sure about the details of that?
No, I'm not.
Okay. You know, I'm kind of curious about that specifically with the algorithm stuff, because, you know, there might have been this serial killer active in kind of like the 90s to early 2000s, you know, just be interesting if there were any kits from that period that were getting tested.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I don't know personally, but I mean, if you find out, let me know, because I've been following algorithms, so this case is very interesting to me as well.
I asked Dr. Lovell, the researcher that was involved in Cleveland's sexual assault kit initiative, whether destroying rape kits was common. They said they would only test the kits going back 10 years and that they were going to, like, throw away their old kits unless victims came forward and said that they wanted them still tested. And you know, it seems like it costs them basically nothing to keep those kits, and kind of you never know, even if you don't have the resources to do it now, you know, that things will get cheaper and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think, and we've seen that as well, and there's been some, I think Politico, maybe it was CNN, I can't remember. Anyway, they did a pretty extensive analysis of destroying rape kits and destroying evidence.
I found the article Lovell was referring to. CNN had surveyed over 200 police departments across all 50 states and found that almost half of them had destroyed some untested kits. Sometimes these kits had been destroyed improperly, and other times they're destroyed in accordance with policy.
I think you see that quite a bit, that law enforcement, they all make their own policies around how long they keep evidence. Some of them are mandated now by states. So Ohio now has, I think it's a 30 years that they have to keep biological evidence. But, you know, if they're following their practices, which they have, you know, written out, and they say, oh, we only keep things 10 years, otherwise we destroy it. I think some of those practices need to be reexamined. And that means that, you know, taxpayers have to fit the bill to provide more storage facilities. But, you know, that to me doesn't seem like an insurmountable problem. And I think if the technology for DNA is telling us anything, it's that it's growing so fast and exponentially getting so much better that, you know, what we couldn't get a DNA profile from now, 10 years from now, who knows? I mean, look at what genealogy testing has done, you know? So the thought that jurisdictions would just throw away evidence would suggest to me that they somehow think that what they're doing now has reached the pinnacle of all technology and that their investigative practices at the time were the best that they could possibly ever be. Two things that I think you just can't assume. And it's a little disconcerting to hear about sort of putting all of the onus onto victims to reach out to the department and say, hey, I know I had this kit. I thought you tested it. How was I to know you didn't test it? And the cost of testing, by the way, as I said, has gone down quite dramatically. So just the testing is about $500 in Ohio. And then to have someone, you know, read the results and write a report is about another $500. So, you know, you're really talking about $1,000 per kit, which in the criminal justice system isn't a huge cost, you know, relative to the outcomes.
I followed up with the Lake County Prosecutor's Office to see if they had more information about what had happened to their older kits. I also wanted to know which jurisdictions within Lake County had participated in the audit. And I've been trying to get answers to these questions since the first week of July. It's now the last week of August, and I've still heard nothing. And it's important to get answers to these questions. When you claim you've solved your rape kit backlog, there's a big difference between doing a proper accounting of all backlog kits and testing them, and doing a partial accounting and then throwing away a substantial number of kits. After radio silence from the Lake County Prosecutor's Office, I continued digging. I came across another article about the initiative from the Chicago Tribune. It mentions that out of the 257 kits found in the audit, 194 were found in Hammond, 31 in East Chicago, and 22 in Maryville. So if you add up those numbers, 247 of the kits were found from those jurisdictions alone. That leaves a maximum of 10 kits that could have been found in Gary, despite the fact that Hammond found 194 kits and they have an almost identical population to Gary. I think the most parsimonious explanation here is that Gary didn't participate in the audit, and it's unclear to what extent they've kept backlog kits or tested them. I was also curious about why Lake County had chosen to destroy kits more than 10 years old. That would mean they would not include kits from 2007 or before. Interestingly, 2007 is the last year that Hargrove's algorithm observed an increase in unsolved strangulations, and Vaughn was arrested the very next year. I wondered at first whether 10 years might be the statute of limitations for rape in Indiana. But when I looked into it, type 1 felony rape has no statute of limitations in Indiana. So it's unclear to me why those kits would not be preserved. But even if Lake County had retained and tested all their kits, it wouldn't necessarily be able to link Darren Vaughn to a homicide, only to a sexual assault. Because the 2017 initiative in Indiana, and most of the initiatives to address rape kit backlogs, don't include DNA from homicide victims.
I do believe that this statewide audit was only for kits taken from a victim in a hospital. I don't know if any of them were taken from homicide victims.
In Cuyahoga County, if there was a murder rape, it went to the homicide unit as compared to the sex crimes unit. So if there was a rape, no homicide, it, you know, it was investigated differently and went to different units. So for the rape kits that we look at, there wasn't murders as part of that. There were rape homicides, but those were sort of in a different category.
Yeah, and so you guys didn't go back and look at those homicide-associated ones as well?
Not as part of the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, but I know the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office might also be looking at some of the rape homicides because there's funding now at the federal level to do some of that, doing, I think, what you're talking about here, sort of expanding out the scope of it.
In fact, last October, the Cuyahoga Prosecutor's Office announced that it had received $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to continue their sexual assault kit testing program. And part of that grant includes a pilot project to do forensic genealogy on 32 samples from sexually motivated homicides. Forensic genealogy is the technique that was used to catch the Golden State Killer. It doesn't just look for complete matches with someone on the CODIS database, but looks for partial matches in CODIS and public DNA databases to find relatives of the perpetrator. Then genealogical techniques and further investigation can be used to identify the offender. Other grants from the Department of Justice are funding similar efforts to help solve cold case homicides. It appears, though, that the emphasis is on going back to cold cases where a DNA profile of the perpetrator had already been generated, but that they had never matched it to a suspect, and the grants give money to use forensic genealogy to try to find that match. I couldn't find any grants, funding, going back, and doing an accounting of all the cold case evidence. Dr. Lovell wonders if an approach similar to Cuyahoga County's Sexual Assault Kit Initiative might benefit homicide investigations as well.
SACI, you know, as successful as it has been, I think it shows that there's great value in going the cold cases, cold case homicides as well, and really trying to see, is there evidence that could be tested? Is there something in terms of genealogy that could be done? Were all the evidence tested? You know, was it tested using current techniques or was it only tested for serology? You know, things like that, that they're starting to ask those questions.
Last July, over a year ago now, I'd reached out to the Lake County coroners to try to find out more information about the victims Hargrove had identified. I was curious if DNA evidence was collected and if it was ever tested and submitted to CODIS, the federal DNA database. I was unable to get answers from the coroner's department about these cases, perhaps because they were unsolved and therefore still open. I'm not sure. But I wonder to what extent older samples from cold cases have gone untested the way rape kits were. I hope that DNA evidence from old homicides like this have been preserved, and I hope if they haven't been tested yet, one day they will be.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
There's a house in your neighborhood that doesn't look so different than yours. A family that everyone feels like they know. A home that is well-kept, leaves raked, snow shoveled. Kids playing in a yard on a summer afternoon. Until one day, when their lives are shattered by a killer who comes out of nowhere, or who's been there all along. My name is Matt Marinovich, and for the new season of Murder Homes, I've found homes whose stories are just a little bit darker. We'll talk to a prisoner convicted of first-degree murder. Follow a crime scene cleanup crew to a horrific tragedy. Take a road trip to a bucolic summer camp in upstate New York, where a preacher buried the bodies of his adoring disciples, and bring you face to face with one of the most unlikely killers of all. Take a walk with me a little further down the street this time, and step inside the home that everyone whispers about to relive a day that will always be frozen in time. You can get 100% ad-free exclusive bonus content, including access to early episodes of Murder Homes, by subscribing to the iHeart True Crime Plus channel today. Available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Listen to Murder Homes Season 2 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Investigating the algorithm and then Darren Vaughn has been a roller coaster. It wasn't at all what I imagined when I first began working on this project, and sometimes I feel like I've gotten so far off my original path that I worry that I've gotten lost, that I'm missing something big, or maybe missing the forest for the trees. And sometimes I find myself wondering, what's the point of solving these cold cases in the first place? Of course, they could potentially lead to the arrest of a violent criminal, a perpetrator who might kill again. But if we're looking specifically for a connection to Vaughn, then what's the point if he's already serving life in prison? I was hoping to find a connection to previous crimes to prove that Hargrove's algorithm had predictive value, that it was able to identify an active serial killer before the police did, and therefore that it would be a valuable tool for law enforcement. I think there's no doubt that the algorithm identified that something very unusual was going on in Gary, with its identification of 15 unsolved strangulations over a 16-year period. I think it's very possible that some of these murders were the work of Vaughn or another serial killer. On the other hand, Gary is a very unusual city where many murders go unsolved. And it's a city full of abandoned buildings where bodies can be hidden or even dumped from homicides in other jurisdictions.
So is this algorithm perfect? No. Can it produce false results? Absolutely. What we tell people always is what the algorithm does is to identify clusters of murders that have an elevated probability of containing serial murder. That just means if the FBI says that serial murder occurs in less than 1% of all homicides, we no longer believe that, but that's the official reckoning for how common serial murder is. Well, if less than 1% of murders are likely to be serial, our algorithm will do better than that. It will identify murders that have a better than 1% probability of containing serial murders. It turns out way better than 1%. We frequently are determining cases that are connected. But there is a failure rate. And what are some of the things that can go south on the algorithm? If you have a police department that has a relentlessly low clearance rate, like the Flint, Michigan Police Department, everything looks serial because there's a low clearance rate for every kind of murder. And there's not much you can do about that. And that's a problem because we're becoming less and less likely to solve a murder in the United States. Today, there are dozens of major cities where most murders go unsolved. That means we're going to get false positives because of the algorithm's technique. We're trying to overcome those challenges, and we have actually. We've made some improvements in the methods. but it's a problem.
I want to look at the algorithm and the ways it might be better used shortly, but first I want to get hypothetical for a moment. Let's say we found evidence that Vaughn was connected to one or more murders on the algorithm's list, proof that Hargrove was right in his 2010 letter. What should police have done? Create a task force to look into evidence that might connect the crimes? Notify the public? And what if police find something more concrete, like DNA evidence or firearm forensics that definitively link multiple murders? Does the public have a right to know that information, even though publicizing that information could let the killer know the detectives are onto them? It seems to me that in a situation like Vaughn's 2014 murders in Gary, where the victims share characteristics, that the police would have had some obligation to warn other possible victims. But it's hard for the police to stop a future homicide from taking place. And in the case of Vaughn's 2014 murders in Gary, police weren't even aware of the murders until after Vaughn's arrest. There was a strong suggestion that some of the victims, like Tierra Beatty, had been murdered thanks to Marvin Clinton's own investigation. But without discovering the bodies and submitting supplemental homicide reports to the FBI, Hargrove's algorithm wouldn't have been able to detect the cluster of Vaughn's 2014 crimes. That made me curious about how many missing persons there are out there and how many of them are really homicide victims. So I called up Todd Matthews. And then to get the levels on my end, can you tell me what you had for breakfast this morning?
I had coffee. I had about 5 cups of coffee today. I'm like a snake. I'll eat once a day. Just eat something nice and solid.
After he helped identify a Jane Doe through web sleuthing, Matthews founded the Doe Network in 1999. It was a national database for missing persons and also unidentified bodies, with the hopes of connecting John and Jane Doe's to missing person reports. Similar to Hargrove, Matthews realized that police departments struggle with solving these kinds of cases, so he decided to create the Doe Network as a tool to help police officers and amateur sleuths with their investigations.
That person could be alive and well. You don't know their circumstances. Some people it's mental illness, some it's dementia, drug abuse, sometimes an accident, sometimes it's murder. You just never know what you're going to get.
And almost a decade after Matthews created the Doe Network, the Department of Justice decided they wanted to make their own official version called NAMUS, that's NAMUS, and they brought in Matthews to help.
The Department of Justice actually first contacted me with NAMUS in 2007 to help them do what Doe Network proved was possible.
Like the Doe Network, NAMUS lists information like a missing person's demographics, when and where they were last seen, and a description of the circumstances of how they went missing. All of that is available to the public. But with NAMUS, detectives working on the case can log in and access additional items.
The evidence, you know, something that Doe Network wouldn't necessarily have its hands on, like the dental records, DNA, fingerprint analysis.
Do you have a sense of kind of to what extent technology is being used in terms of police checking cell phone records or credit card records, things like that?
You do see a lot of that, you know, pinging the cell phone. And then if a cell phone's been disabled, you know, that kind of leads you to think of foul play, possibly. But it is getting better as far as if you swipe a card or carry a phone, it's hard to go missing. It's not easy to be a missing person and still work, eat, sleep, you know, do something. It's hard to make yourself missing on purpose now. For the good or the bad, it's just harder to do it. But it's going to happen. You know, people are going to be able to get around some of those things that they truly want to be missing. And that's where some of the privacy concerns come in. You know, if I want to go missing, can I? Is it morally okay for me to just allow my family to think that I'm, you know, they don't know where I am?
Yeah.
A lot of issues, a lot of things to think about.
This podcast is kind of looking into the work of this serial killer, and he was caught for one murder, confessed to 6 more murders, and led the police to their bodies. You know, some of them had been reported missing at that point. Others hadn't even been reported missing. I guess I'm curious of just like how good of a sense do we have of how big this problem actually is? And kind of are we doing everything we can be doing to keep track of this stuff and monitor it?
Well, it's a silent mass disaster. It's called the nation's silent mass disaster because of the time frames, the distances.
According to NamUs, there are currently over 20,000 missing person cases. Some of those will be resolved quickly, with the missing person found alive and safe. But some are people who have been killed, but their body was never found. Or if it was found, there are John or Jane Doe waiting to be identified. But Matthew says the database isn't yet comprehensive. Whether cases get entered into NamUs varies from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
My home state of Tennessee, I work with local officials, and in 30 days in Tennessee, you're supposed to go. If you're missing or unidentified in Tennessee, within 30 days, you're supposed to go on the NamUs website. Now, whether that happens or not, there's no punishment phase for not. And the requiring of use of NamUs in state law actually does other things. It begins a training process with law enforcement. So it now will be part of the training academies so that they know the laws that are required. And eventually, things will change. And I think we planted a lot of seeds that are going to grow and evolve. Technology is going to get better, and I think we're all going to get better at it. It just seems like it takes so long. If you're the family member of a missing, 2 seconds is a very painful time period.
Yeah.
There's probably nothing more scary than having a missing family member and you have no control over it. You have no idea if they're alive, they're dead, they're hungry, they're cold. You have no idea what to do or even where to begin looking. That's probably one of the most helpless feelings, as described to me by people that have done it. They've all been described very similarly. Hmm. The most helpless feeling that they've ever had. I've had people I've known for years, and they know of my work and recognize and appreciate it. And then suddenly they're in that situation. That's when things change dramatically. You don't know until you're sitting there in that chair. You don't know how bad it can be. Literally, there's a local missing person, and I've known the boy's aunt for more than 20 years. And now I hear from her more frequently. They're looking for him. He's a young adult. He's had some drug issues, and he might not necessarily be on the top of the list for law enforcement to look for.
Yeah.
That doesn't change her situation. He's still her nephew, and she wants him found. And I don't blame her. And it's just by the time you realize how bad it can be, you're probably already snake bit,
And when you say, not at the top of the list for law enforcement to look for, what do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of times if somebody has had some trouble, it's just like, well, are they missing or are they just staying out of the way? Have they done something? Are they hiding out for some reason? So it's just hard to sometimes see somebody that they might recognize as a criminal as a vulnerable victim. Now, I know the local boy that's missing, he has a really bad case of diabetes, and he cannot survive without medication. So unless he's found some way to buy medication somewhere, he can't have survived it, and his family knows that. So where's he at? So now we're into day 65 of his disappearance. The family realized that he can't survive. He's not come back to them. And it's getting way down the line now. Now it's recovery of remains instead of finding somebody potentially in a bad situation.
Does that police attitude frustrate you, or do you think that is just kind of the way that it is?
It is the way that it is. It does get frustrating at times, especially when you know somebody like this person. I knew that family. And it's always this: my son would never do that. Yeah, he will. My daughter didn't have a tattoo. Maybe she did. You just didn't know about it. So you're going to hear somebody say, my child would never do that. My adult child would never, ever, ever, ever not call me. And most of the time, it's just like, well, maybe it is possible. But then when you do know people and you know who they are and their story is really making sense, and it's like, yeah, you're right. He probably would not be without medication for this period of time. So something's wrong, even though he might have done things that put him on the wrong side of the law. Ultimately, he is endangered, so we have to think about this differently. So it is frustrating at times, but I understand, because when I was with Department of Justice with NamUs, the volume of people reaching out can be overwhelming. So I can see how you can quickly get frustrated getting multiple calls, and we have to make it easier to do. We have to make more tools available to the family. They can enter their own missing person case in NamUs. They can start the ball rolling. So instead of waiting for law enforcement to do it, they can start the process. It'll have to be validated, but at least it gives them something to do instead of waiting for somebody to come and help them. They can start the process, because when you're getting validation reports coming back from a program that's developed by the Department of Justice, I mean, I think they're not just going to tell Justice Agency, oh, they'll be back, we're not going to look for them. You know, I think once they see that we don't really need you to create a profile, NamUs has a profile, kind of takes a little bit out of their control.
Yeah.
And has that helped? It has helped. It's helped tremendously. Has it cleared it up completely? No.
When you kind of like look really big picture, is there a direction that we're heading with technology or the way we investigate stuff?
It's only going to improve ultimately. You know, it's going to be quicker to do the DNA test. Encouraging the families, like at one point in time, every senior at my local high school was fingerprinted, because I will go and bring local law enforcement in their forensic class and we'll thumbprint everybody or fingerprint everybody, get a 10 print. And then, you know, you put it away and God forbid, I hope I never have to see it again. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things that can be done, but I mean, it's at some price. You know, you are going to have to think about things that make you uncomfortable and, you know, thinking of a person that might be deceased and that's not what you want. But it is what it is. We're all going to die eventually. And I think we can accept a natural death. It's just, we're not programmed to have a missing person. There's no funeral. There's no closure. There's no explanation for it. There's no way to process. I've seen families grow stronger as a result of it. And then they go on to pass state laws and advocate and make sure nobody suffers what they suffer. I've seen other families deteriorate because of it, because there's no way to move on.
Yeah.
It just can be devastating. I had a local lady that her son's been missing for many years, and she wanted to show me something. She took me to the grave. She actually had a tombstone put up for her son next to her and her husband. She goes, if we're gone, can you make sure he's buried here if his body's found? She's give up. You know, she knows that she's at the end, and she's getting older, and, you know, it's going to become more and more difficult for her to try to find, and her hope of finding him during her lifetime is fading. And she only wants now is, can you make sure he's buried here? Will you let him know our wishes? I don't want him laying in a lab in a box. You know, I can say, you know what, I'll do everything I can.
Yeah.
And I know your wishes and I'll make them known. You know, I have to think about, will I even be around when his body is found, if it's found? So I think the best way to do is to tell that story, mention it somewhere, and then, you know, that's it. You just have to share it.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
There's a house in your neighborhood that doesn't look so different than yours. A family that everyone feels like they know. A home that is well-kept, leaves raked, snow shoveled. Kids playing in a yard on a summer afternoon. Until one day, when their lives are shattered by a killer who comes out of nowhere, or who's been there all along. My name is Matt Marinovich, and for the new season of Murder Homes, I've found homes whose stories are just a little bit darker.
We'll talk to a prisoner convicted of first-degree murder. Follow a crime scene cleanup crew to a horrific tragedy. Take a road trip to a bucolic summer camp in upstate New York, where a preacher buried the bodies of his adoring disciples, and bring you face to face with one of the most unlikely killers of all. Take a walk with me a little further down the street this time, and step inside the home that everyone whispers about to relive a day that will always be frozen in time. You can get 100% ad-free exclusive bonus content, including access to early episodes of Murder Homes, by subscribing to the iHeart True Crime Plus channel today. Available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Listen to Murder Homes Season 2 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I began researching this show, I asked myself the question, with all the data we're collecting, storing, sorting, why is it that we're getting worse at solving homicides? When it comes to policing, we are starting to do more with data, but we're not really doing it in any kind of systematic way. I think it's reasonable to worry about new technologies like facial recognition, that they might be moving our country towards some sort of surveillance state. But I think the real nightmare right now is much more banal. We're missing important connections we could be making and letting killers go free. One of the things that surprised me about Hargrove's algorithm was how simple it was. This wasn't some sort of deep learning neural network getting fed mountains of data. It was a simple, handcrafted algorithm getting basic demographic information about the victims, along with the method of killing, year, and jurisdiction. And you can imagine that with richer data and a more involved algorithm, patterns might emerge more clearly. In fact, Hargrove has been working on an updated algorithm.
I know you said, you know, that you're still in publication for the algorithm 2.0. Is there anything you can talk about that?
We want to get into a peer-reviewed journal, and so we're still writing. I can tell you that what is different about the newer version of the algorithm is it dynamically evaluates each murder. What the old algorithm did was just to create a group and then to assess what the clearance rate was for the group. The new algorithm individually assesses each murder and then decides whether or not that murder looks suspicious. And that individual assessment is better. And so it definitely is an improvement over the old. And so once we get it published, we'll make it available. But we need that confirmation that we're onto something. And so we need others to look at it. And right now we're struggling with following the format for peer-reviewed publications. And apparently one of our reviewers is a former cop and took offense to what we did. I guess he or she thought that the algorithm made police look bad. I don't understand that, because we got several former cops on the list of authors with this project. It's not our intent to ever make law enforcement look bad. We're just trying to provide a new tool in the toolkit.
I'm hoping that a bunch of people will listen to this podcast, and some of them might be data scientists or people like that. And I was curious, if someone wants to help you with this kind of work, they have some idea of something they want to try with the data. Is that something you're interested in?
We make our data available. If you go to murderdata.org and go to the data and docs tab, you can download everything, absolutely everything, the original algorithm and the raw data. And we encourage folks to use the data and see if they can come up with something useful. We are hoping that someone may be able to get artificial intelligence to do clever things with these records. So far, all attempts that have been made have not been successful, but that doesn't mean something good mightn't happen in the future. So we're hoping that bright people will take free data and see if they can come up with something clever.
At the beginning of the podcast, I also mentioned a startling statistic, that homicides today are being cleared at a much lower rate than in previous decades. No one knows exactly why the clearance rate for homicides is decreasing, but Hargrove has some ideas.
Murder begets murder, and unsolved murder really begets murder. When most killings go unsolved, there starts to develop a narrative that the only way I'm going to get justice for my loved ones is to take the law into my own hands. Also, murderers who walk the street are available to kill again. Why wouldn't they? They got away with it the first time. We are convinced that serial murder is much, much more common than anyone ever dreamed of, even in their nightmares. Now, that's not to say that serial sexual murder is on the rise. It's not. The traditional Hollywood kind of serial killer is definitely on the decline. But the statistical serial killer, anyone who kills two or more people in separate incidents, that really is certainly more common than is recognized. It is quite likely that the most common type of serial murder is the gang enforcer on a local street gang. How many of those killings get solved? I mean, increasingly, people who have gotten adept at committing murder and getting away with it are just getting away with it. We believe that the decline in homicide clearance rate is primarily driven by a lack of leadership, a lack of public passion that murders should be solved, a lack of resources for homicide detectives, a lack of accountability. The clearance rate for homicides should be a metric that policymakers carefully follow in determining whether or not a police department is effective. When mayors of cities pledge to get a handle on their murder problem, generally speaking, the murder rate starts to drop. Improved clearance rates will reduce the rate at which murder occurs. It's not easy and it's not cheap. Increasingly, there's a competition for limited resources in major cities. Many cities cannot afford their pension plan. I mean, the fiscal challenges for modern government are becoming extreme. We in America have to make major crimes a higher priority. We cannot dismiss murders because, well, just the kinds of people that get murdered I don't care about, which I'm afraid may be part of the dreadful calculus as to what's happened. It is our hope at the Murder Accountability Project that our data become a political force, that people can look up the rate at which murders are cleared in their communities. And if they don't like what they see, they should have a conversation with their mayor and their city council members that unsolved murder is simply unacceptable.
And Hargrove's analysis of the declining clearance rate for murder shows that it's driven by homicides where the victim is Black.
The entirety of that declining homicide clearance rate was borne by African-American victims. In cases of Caucasian murder, Asian murder, Native American murder, those murders are about as likely to be solved today as they were 50 years ago. That's just a fact, and we should never ignore what the data show us.
Today, if your loved one is murdered and they're white, there's over a 75% chance someone will be arrested for the crime. If they're Black, the chance someone will be arrested drops below 60%. And the chance of being murdered is much higher for Black Americans, particularly young Black men. As I mulled over these statistics, I kept thinking back to my interview with Carrie Rice, the police officer who responded to Vaughn's gasoline incident. When I Googled him, I saw an article about how one of his sons had been shot and killed.
You know, I saw that your family has kind of personally been affected by violent crime.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about that and how it, you know, if it has changed the perspective on the work that you do.
Like I said, I've had a lot of family members killed in this city. All the way back far as 98. When my nephew was killed, actually before that, in 86, my older brother was killed. It really didn't affect me too much in doing my job. I know I still had a job to do, and I did it. And it really, you know, after a while, you don't think about it too much. The last two people in my family, actually, they had two sons that were killed within in the past year. So,
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's homicide is one of the leading causes of death for young Black men. And, You know, I don't know if you have any thoughts from kind of your perspective in law enforcement or just in general, what people can do as individuals or what we can do as a broader society to change that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really believe that that there's two main things that need to be done. And one of them I was running a truancy court, making sure the kids went to school and got an education. And it's a shame that you have to make some parents actually send their kids to school, but they just don't understand how that affects a kid when they get older. I guarantee you at least 70% of people we arrest here in Gary don't have a high school diploma. And I think that feeds into the crime. Because everybody's going to grow up, everybody's going to want things, and when you can't even read the fill out application, your job choices are limited. So, and another thing that I really think need to be addressed is mental health. You have a lot of females that have been sexually molested and never got any treatment. And you had a lot of males that have been either sexually molested or have been in the car with somebody or around somebody and they got shot and killed. Or they've been shot before and they patched the body up, but they never talked to them about the mental issues. And you know, most black men, they refuse to go to counseling. And I, like I say, after what happened, you know, in my family, I had to go and I'm glad I went. But the average person, average male don't want to go and they just don't understand how much they need it. But that's a lot of it. You know, the lack of education and people been abused and have no clue even now how that's really affecting their everyday decisions.
Hargrove's algorithm can definitely highlight a place where something is going wrong. But when it comes to preventing future homicides, I don't think technology is going to provide us with any magic bullets. The real solutions are going to be less glamorous. They're solutions that sound almost like cliches, things we already know we should be doing. Supporting children and protecting them from abuse, providing mental health services, cleaning up neighborhoods and demolishing derelict buildings, and taking violent crime seriously regardless of who the victim is or where the crime took place. This is the end of the weekly episodes of Algorithm, but it's not the end of the show. Many factors facilitated Darren Vaughn's killing spree, and there's still some angles I'd like to explore. I've already got bonus episodes planned and ideas for another season, but I'd love to hear your questions and your ideas. Please reach out to me or call and leave a voicemail at 888-501-3309. We're going to have another Q&A episode soon. And if you haven't yet, please do subscribe to our podcast feed so you don't miss any updates. And you can find all this information and the social media for the podcast in the show notes. This episode was written and produced by me, Ben Kiebrick. Algorithm is executive produced by Alex Williams, Donald Albright, and Matt Frederick. Production assistance and mixing by Eric Quintana. The music is by Makeup and Vanity Set and Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks to Christina Dana, Miranda Hawkins, Jamie Albright, Rima El-Kayali, Trevor Young, and Josh Thane for their help and notes. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, the awful truth is you could just about pick any major American city and take a shovel. I promise you, serial murder is more common than we ever want to believe. If this project ends up having legs, Atlanta would be a good place to go, frankly. It's the largest cluster our computer knows about. In fact, he was of the opinion that some of these might be solvable.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or a ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
Ladies and gentlemen.
gentlemen. We are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.